There's an adage that says that the best preacher in the world cannot compete with a man opening the window. And I was thinking today, the best topic in the world probably cannot compete with the elections, but I'm very happy to see that all of you have come. If you haven't voted, it's too late anyway, so you might as well stay. I have an abstract, and in the paper, I will be reading the paper and then making comments. One reason I chose this route was because this topic may be a little esoteric, and hence being able to see what I'm saying, I think would be helpful. I also have some overheads that I will be showing as well to try to explain and add a little more information to some of these points. So as we read through it, I won't start with the abstract. The abstract was adequately handled by the little blurb that was read by Bob. So what I want to do is I mentioned that I want to handle this from both a historical and an experimental standpoint. Historical because I want to give some of the history leading up to the conclusion that has been made by young Earth creationists concerning the travel time of light in the universe, but then also I want to end with some experiments that were made, that have been made in order to prove what we will call the second postulate of Einsteinian relativity, his special relativity. So with that as introduction, let's look at the topic. Let's look at the introduction on the first page, and then we'll go right along. Objects in the universe are observed by virtue of the radiation they emit. As a matter of fact, anything that we observe is because it is emitting light. Either it's emitting the light in and of itself, or it's reflecting light off some other source, and we are able to see it. Without that, we wouldn't be able to observe anything. And I use the term light loosely, any kind of radiation, whether you're looking at x-rays or whether you're looking at microwaves, what have you. The only way we can observe anything is by the irradiation that is given off by that object, either reflected by that object or initiated by that object. Very distant objects are measured in billions of light years away by astronomers. Hence, by definition, light from these objects has taken billions of years to reach the Earth. It is concluded, therefore, that the universe is billions of years old. Astronomers like to use the term light year for distance. It turns out to be about 6 trillion miles. In order to avoid having to put 12 zeros after every number and talking in distances in terms of trillions and billions of trillions of miles, etc., the concept of the light year is used, how far light travels in 1 year's time. Light travels about 186,000 miles a second, and then you multiply it through by the various multiples. It turns out to be 6 trillion miles to the light year. Therefore, if something is 10 light years away, it means it's taken 10 years for the light to reach us from that object. If it's 100 light years away, it's taken 100 years, etc. Through various techniques that astronomers have, they've been able to measure objects that are literally billions of light years away. Hence, by definition, it has taken billions of years for that light that has been emitted by that object to reach us here on Earth. Therefore, the assumption, of course, is that the object did not emit the light before it was formed. And if it's taken 10 billion years for the light to reach us, then the object is at least 10 billion years old. That's basically the way the argument goes. The usual retort to this argument by those who believe that the universe is only a few thousand years old is to claim that the universe was created with the radiation en route from the emitting objects. Hence, it is argued that no correspondence exists between the apparent distance and the actual distance of the radiating body. The universe may have an apparent age of billions of years, but its actual age is only a few thousand years. What you have here basically is a corollary of the apparent age view, that things were created to look mature, and part of that maturity is to have radiation from an object that may be very distant, but the radiation was already created on its way to the Earth. It's just a corollary of the apparent age view. In a continuing effort by young Earth creationists, that is those who feel that the Earth is and the universe is only a few thousand years old, to show the youth of the universe, another explanation has appeared, which allows material bodies to be located at great distances, while the light travel time from them remains quite short, on the order of 15.7 years. The remainder of this discussion centers around the validity of this latter explanation. I don't want to handle the apparent age view. I say a continuing effort. Paul White was gracious enough to let me see a copy of Impact, articles on science and creation, and basically what I'm going to discuss is given in this little flyer as to how the material bodies of the universe may be very, very far away, but in reality, even from the most distant object, the light would only take a little more than 15 and a half years to get here. You see how that avoids the problem of age. You can put the objects as far out as you like. You don't have to talk about billions of years that it would take for the light to reach us. It gets here in just a little over 15 years. So this particular argument I found to be very popular in creation literature. Let's give a little historical background. Ever since Einstein's second postulate of special relativity, that the velocity of light in a vacuum is independent of the motion of either the source or the observer, many have attempted to give an alternate theory which retains so-called Galilean relativity. Don't panic. I'm going to define what I mean. The difference between Einsteinian and Galilean relativity can be seen with the following example. Suppose you have an airplane that's moving along. The airplane has guns, both forward section and its aft section. And the example I give here, the bullets leave the guns of the plane with a velocity of 2,000 feet a second. And we assume that the plane can go 1,000 feet a second. Now, the plane is coming towards us, firing its guns, and you have a very dedicated physicist who is going to measure the speed of the bullets that are coming towards him. And common sense, our common experience would tell us that if the plane is moving 1,000 feet per second and the gun is able to fire bullets at 2,000 feet per second, the speed at which the bullets will come by us, neglecting air resistance, is going to be 3,000 feet per second. Now, if you turn the plane around, it didn't get us the first time, so it's not going to shoot us again on its way away from us. It's moving away from us at 1,000 feet per second. The bullets are being fired from its aft guns towards us at 2,000 feet per second. Bullets come towards us at 2,000. The plane is moving away at 1,000. In effect, you have a reduction of the speed of the bullets, and they would just pass us at 1,000 feet a second. In short, in this particular case, you add the velocities of the bullet into the plane when the plane is moving towards us. You subtract the velocities when they are moving away from us. We get the same thing when we're driving in an automobile. If we're going at 40 miles an hour and somebody passes at 60 miles per hour, his speed relative to us is 20 miles per hour. If they're heading towards each other, the relative speed is 60 plus 40 or 100 miles an hour. That's basically Galilean relativity. It's a simple addition of speeds. Towards the bottom paragraph now, on page 2, Einsteinian relativity, on the other hand, operates quite differently. Suppose now that the plane is moving at a very great speed, say, one half the speed of light, and that it shoots laser beams, which travel at the speed of light in a vacuum, hereon called the normal speed of light. You're going to have a Star Wars type of situation here. As the plane attacks the observer on the ground, one would think that the laser beams would dash by the observer with a speed of 1 1/2 times the normal speed of light. 1/2 the speed of light for the plane, 100%, one unit for the speed of light being emitted by the plane, half the speed of light plus the speed of light gives you 1.5. When the plane is approaching you, you would think that as the plane finally passes by you and fires the laser from its aft lasers, that since the plane is moving half the speed of light in one direction, the speed of light in the other direction, you subtract the two, and the speed of light, the speed of the rays coming from the laser towards you would only be half the speed of light. Again, an analogous situation to what you have with the guns. However, this is not the case. And here's the critical difference between the Galilean relativity and the Einsteinian relativity. In fact, regardless of the motion of the plane, the laser beam speed would continue to be that of the normal speed of light, no more and no less. In other words, what I'm saying is the speed of light is constant. If you were to measure the speed of light, it would be constant regardless of how quickly the object which is emitting the light would be moving towards you or away from you. It also works out the same whether it's moving transverse to your line of sight, any direction, up, away, forward, back, down. It doesn't matter. The speed of light would still be constant. Now, there's a reason for this. If that weren't the case, this may seem weird, but if it weren't the case, then you would destroy causality in the world. You would destroy cause and effects relationships if that were not the case. I don't want to get into that at this point, but some of the strange effects that this brings about would be even stranger. The world would even be stranger if this were not the case. This constancy of the velocity of light, regardless of the motion of the source or the observer, is one of the outcomes of Einstein's special theory of relativity. Other strange occurrences in Einsteinian relativity are: no material object can travel faster than the normal speed of light. What happens? It begins to gain mass if it begins to approach the speed of light. It gets bigger in terms of more massive. Material objects gain mass as they gain momentum, that is, as they go faster. A stick moving parallel to its length shortens. A yardstick moving parallel to its length at a very high velocity, approaching that the velocity of light, would appear to shrink. And a moving clock runs slower when compared to non-moving clocks. You could set your watches, synchronize watches, and then the watch that would be moving at a very high velocity would appear to tick slower, more slowly to you, than your own watch. Again, very, very strange effects. You may wonder, why don't I notice any of these? And the answer is because we don't move that fast. The people who really notice these are the people who work with some atomic particles that are accelerated at nearly the velocity of light. All of these effects have been seen. The only effect that hasn't been measured directly is the one of the shortening of the length of an object. But the lengthening of the clock, the longer time it takes to do things at a faster velocity has been measured. The increase in mass has been measured. The fact that no matter how much energy you add to an object, it will not go faster than the speed of light. The gain in mass, all these things have been measured. These things are measured daily by atomic physicists and particle physicists. All of these effects have been experimentally verified, hence in spite of strange effects, Einstein's theory has long been held as the proper formulation for explaining kinematic, that is the motion of objects, and electromagnetic phenomena. However, since the results of this theory are so contrary to human experience, various efforts have been made to explain high-speed physical phenomena without abolishing ordinary, that is Galilean, ideas of space and time. The most serious contender to Einstein's theory was presented by Walter Ritz in 1908, who argued for the constancy of the velocity of light with respect to the emitting source. This is basically a variation of Galilean relativity. By this time, the so-called Michelson-Morley experiment had been done that showed that no matter how an observer is moving, the speed of light was constant. So he said, okay, let's make the following assumption that if an object is moving in a certain direction, that it gives off, if it gives off radiation, the speed of that radiation will be the normal speed of light when measured by somebody fixed to the emitting source. Now, this may change for an observer, but this was basically his assumption, not that the speed of light was constant, but that the speed of light depended upon the motion of the source. If the source was moving towards you, you would measure a light speed that would be going a little faster. If the motion of the source was away from you, you would measure a light speed that was going a little slower than the normal velocity of light. An observer would then find that the velocity of light depends upon the relative velocity between him and the source. So a first approximation, Ritz's hypothesis was in keeping with the experiments of his day. Later experiments, however, raised serious questions about the Ritz hypothesis. Willem de Sitter, a Dutchman, 1913, argued that Ritz's assumption would introduce spurious eccentricities in the orbits of visual binary stars. I'll show you by a diagram what I mean by these two paragraphs on the page. De Sitter's effect arises from the fact that the light from the components of the binary system moving towards the Earth travels faster than when the same component is moving away from the Earth. Visually, the system would appear more eccentric than allowed by the laws of mechanics, but De Sitter noticed no such effects. In 1942, Peter Bergman, who was a student of Einstein's, argued that the Ritz hypothesis would produce multiple star images in visual binaries. Again, no such effects have been seen. The negative results of the above observations were used as evidence against the Ritz hypothesis. Now, let me just explain what I mean. Look at the upper left. The diagram of a binary star, binary system, where one star is going around the other. We'll assume that the center star is pretty much stationary and the other star is moving around it in a counterclockwise dimension. You may wonder what indeed happens if the speed of light doesn't change, if indeed it is true that the speed of light does not change, regardless of what the emitting source is doing, does anything happen? The answer is yes. You get what is known as the Doppler shift. And basically, an object that is moving towards you, emitting radiation at a certain frequency, when you measure that radiation, the frequency will appear a little higher. If you have a light bulb and you move it towards you at a very high velocity, the light bulb will appear bluer. If it's moving away from you at a very high velocity, it will appear redder. And this is what the so-called blue shift and red shift terms mean. Now, light from this star would shift a little bit towards the blue as it would be moving towards you. Earth is down, and the light would appear a little redder as the star would be moving away from us. As the star moves perpendicular to our line of sight, either up here or this part of the orbit, then no difference in the frequency in the radiation is seen. This, by the way, is a common occurrence. I think all of you have experienced that either as trains go by or cars go by that toot their whistles or blow their horns. As they're coming towards you, they blow their horn, and if they continue blowing it as they pass you, what you'll hear is something like this. Beep. You ever heard something like that? If a train's coming by, you don't even have to have it blow its whistle. You can just hear from the noise of the train. It sounds a little higher pitched as it is approaching you and a little lower pitched as it's moving away from you. This is all part of the Doppler shift, and it happens with light rays as well as it does with sound rays. Now, the idea behind what Sitter and Bergman were saying is the following. According to Ritz, let's take a look at this part of the orbit of a star in a binary system. As the star is moving towards the Earth, the light emitted by that star, if Ritz were correct, would move a little faster than the light emitted by this star when it's 180 degrees away, moving away from us. In this case, where you see redshift here, the speed of light, according to Ritz, coming towards the Earth, would move a little more slowly than the star over here. You get no change in the velocity or the speed of light for the top position and the bottom position. Now, what Wilhelm de Sitter was saying is the following. If this light is moving a little faster than this light, light from this part of the orbit will get to the Earth more quickly than light from this part of the orbit. The net effect will be to make the star appear to be moving faster in its orbit when it is approaching the Earth than when it is receding from the Earth. In other words, instead of having a nice, steady, circular motion, what it would appear to happen is that in one part of the orbit, the star would be moving towards you, it would appear to move towards you very quickly, and then slow up as it's moving away. It'll move very quickly and slow up. Well, the only way that can occur now, if you have two stars, is for a star not being a circular orbit, but an elliptical orbit. And when you have an elliptical orbit, when the object that is orbiting around the central object is near the central object, it moves more quickly than when it gets out farther away from the central object. But observations would show you really have a circular orbit here. And yet it would appear the motion of the star would appear as though it really had an elliptical orbit. But observations would show it had a circular orbit. And hence you'd have a discrepancy between the expected velocity of the star, which would be constant, instead of having a constant velocity, which would be expected by observing the orbit of the star, you would have spurious motions that would occur. Bergman was arguing something even more drastic could occur. Suppose the star were moving around the orbit very quickly, then this light coming towards us would move much more quickly than this light when the star is moving away from us. Now, presumably, you could have the following situation. Suppose you have a light pulse emitted over in this part of the orbit that is traveling towards the Earth. When the star gets over here, it emits another light pulse, which is traveling more quickly, and then that pulse reaches the Earth more quickly than the initial pulse. If you think about it a little bit, what that will appear to do is produce multiple images of the stars in its orbit. If you were close enough, you wouldn't see too much of an effect. But if you were far enough away from the binary, eventually, as you observe the binary, it would appear as though there are ghost stars. First, you would see one star in the orbit. Then you might see two stars in the orbit as a result of the overlap of the light, maybe three stars. Then you go back to one star. In other words, it would be a mess. It would be kind of a complicated situation. But the very fact that the light from this part of the orbit overtakes the light emitted from other parts of the orbit would make it appear as though you have stars sort of appearing and disappearing. And again, it would make for a very funny system. Well, none of this was actually found. De Sitter investigated quite a number of binary systems, found nothing along those lines. So he basically felt that the proposal by Ritz was incorrect. Bergman again found nothing. Astronomers looking at that time found nothing to indicate that there were ghost images appearing, and hence again it was felt that the Ritz hypothesis was incorrect. In 1953, however, and now this is the work by Moon and Spencer that most of the creationists have latched onto, they analyzed a number of visual binaries to see whether the phenomenon predicted by Bergman would really be visible in the first place. They assumed the Ritz hypothesis, but their computation showed that Bergman's predicted multiple images for binaries would, in fact, not occur. Said the binaries are too close. You have to have a certain spatial distance between the Earth and the binaries in order to give the light from this part of the orbit time to overtake the light coming from this part of the orbit. If it's too close, it's not going to happen. But if it's far enough away, then that will occur. And basically, they analyzed the distance to the binaries, and they said none of them are really close enough, none of them are really far enough for this multiple image to occur in the first place. They don't comment on the sitter's results on spurious eccentricities. One does not know whether they re-examined his data or not. Hence, they concluded that visual binaries proved absolutely nothing about the constancy of the velocity of light. In the same article, Moon and Spencer performed a similar analysis of spectroscopic binaries and Cepheid variables, which I'll explain what they are. They indicated that the Ritz hypothesis would produce spurious spectral lines, but no such phenomenon was observed. Now, let me take Cepheid variables, and I'll show you what I mean by the spectroscopic binaries. A Cepheid variable is a star that pulsates. They're very bright, and hence they can be seen for very, very great distances. They're one of the methods by which astronomers use to indicate distances. They have a periodic brightening and dimming as a result of the pulsation. They are unstable stars, so they pulsate for a few million years. And the situation that you have is the following. The star expands, then contracts, expands and contracts. Now, the effect that Moon and Spencer were looking for is the following. It's very similar to what we saw with the binaries. During the expansion phase, such as here and here, when the outside of the star is moving towards us, if you have a star that's expanding, the part that we see would be moving towards us. During the expansion phase, if the Ritz hypothesis were correct, then the light being emitted by the star, by the surface of the star moving towards us, would be traveling more quickly than the light during the contraction phase, when the surface of the star is moving towards the center of the star and away from us. So you have a fast velocity for light, slow velocity. Fast velocity, slow velocity. Again, the situation would be that since the velocity of the light given off by the star during the expansion phase is moving more quickly than the velocity of the light during the contraction phase, eventually the light being emitted during the expansion phase would overtake the light being emitted during the contraction phase. And instead of having a nice curve that brightens and dims, what you would do is, again, have a mishmash. You would have a lot of spurious effects that would occur. However, none was seen. Now, the advantage of using Cepheid variables is the fact that Cepheid variables are far enough away because of their brightness so that if the Ritz hypothesis indeed was true, that the speed of light depended on the motion of the source, one would see an effect, unlike the binaries that are too close. One would see an effect with the Cepheids. The spectroscopic binaries, these particular binaries are binaries where you cannot see the two components, but by using a spectrometer, which is able to detect light at various frequencies, you can pick up the red and the blue shift of the stars as they are moving towards you or away from you. And in this situation, when the two stars are moving transverse to the line of sight, there's no shift, and the bottom spectrum represents that. This is just an analysis of the light coming from these two stars. But as the star moves towards you and away from you, then you have the top situation. And what you see is two lines merging into one, and then they would move out the other direction, merge into one, and you keep seeing the two lines moving back and forth, merging and separating, as a result of the motion of the stars. But again, when the star, if the light given off by the star moving towards us is moving more quickly than the light given off by the star that was moving away from us, again, you wouldn't see this nice pattern. you would again begin to see some strange effects that would occur. Again, none was observed. So Moon and Spencer, now at the bottom of page 4, gave two possible explanations for the negative spectroscopic results, both on Cepheid variables and also on the spectroscopic variables. And the two conditions that they said are the following. Either the velocity of light is constant after all, in favor of Einstein, or, and the Ritz hypothesis is wrong, or the velocity of light is constant with respect to the source, in favor of Ritz, but space is curved. And the curvature of space that they proposed was an attempt to get light to take a shortcut here from the position where the object is located. In other words, what they were trying to do is to say, these objects, the Cepheid variables, are very far away, and if light took the normal path here, we should have observed the result. We didn't observe any results. Let's assume that the light takes a shortcut. Let's assume that the space in which the light travels is sort of bent in on itself, and that will enable light to get here faster than it would by taking the more distant route. In the latter case, they say, although astronomical space is unchanged, the time for light to reach the Earth is greatly reduced, thereby eliminating the time differential necessary to observe multiple images. In their own words, they say, assume that light travels in a Riemannian space. Riemannian, just a German mathematician who worked with curved spaces, and hence we talk about curved space or Riemannian space. The usual distance, they claim, employed by astronomers is unchanged as regards material bodies, but for light, it is replaced by the corresponding Riemannian distance. In essence, therefore, the method of this paper leaves astronomical space unchanged, but reduces the time required for light to travel from a star to the Earth. Again, it takes a shortcut. They're talking about a shortcut. By appealing to their data, these authors fixed the radius of curvature of the universe at 5 light years. In such a universe, light from the most distant objects would reach the Earth in only 15.7 years, thereby ensuring that the predicted effects of Bergman and presumably de Sitter would not be seen. Should say, by the way, that present estimates are that objects, most distant objects found, quasars, are out about 8 billion light years. So what they would claim is that, okay, it's really that far away, but the light only takes a little over 15 and a half years to get here because it's taking a shortcut, because the space in which the light travels is different than the space in which you have the material bodies, and therefore the light from these objects would get here in a little over 15 and a half years. The results of Moon and Spencer have been favorably received in young Earth circles. Whitcomb and Morris comment that the very fact that such a theory can be developed and seriously considered, that demonstrates, not demonstrates, that astronomy has nothing really definite as yet to say about the age of the universe. Harold Schlesinger accepts Moon and Spencer's result as being, quote, in line with the number of physical indicators that the universe is quite young. And George Mulfinger states that, quote, to the best of my knowledge, this original paper has never been refuted. Now, to compound the difficulty, in addition to the challenge of Moon and Spencer, that is the challenge to Einsteinian relativity, J.G. Fox, who's at Carnegie Mellon, has also breathed new life into the Ritz hypothesis. Fox argues as follows. The velocity of the radiation emitted by a source is not the critical factor. What really matters is its velocity after passing through some kind of a medium. That is, through some kind of a gas, through a lot of dust, through some kind of an atmosphere. A star, for example, that gives off radiation below the outer atmosphere. And Fox is saying, now what happens to this light as it passes through some kind of an atmosphere or passes through a large gas cloud? He argues as follows. If this medium, that is the material through which the light is passing, is stationary or moving very slowly with respect to the observer, then the velocity of the radiation is, quote, neutralized to the normal velocity of light. That is, even though the velocity of the radiation emitted by an object may initially differ, even greatly, from the normal velocity of light, passage of this radiation through a stationary medium of sufficient depth will destroy any evidence of the radiation's initial speed. So what he's saying is, suppose I have a large gas cloud here through which the light passes, and it's fairly stationary with respect to the observer on Earth. Now I have a light beam coming very, very quickly. By the time it travels through this medium and exits it and comes through you, it will have slowed down to the normal velocity of light. It goes on to argue binaries are enveloped with gas. Cepheid variables have atmospheres. They are enveloped with gas. Therefore, what he's saying is, even if at the surface at which the light is emitted, even if it is emitted at a velocity that is faster than the speed of light, by the time it travels through the atmosphere, it would have been slowed down to the normal velocity of light. Hence, he says, no evidence can be deduced from the observations of de Sitter and Bergman to disprove the Ritz hypothesis. Says because, in effect, we're not seeing to the place where the light was emitted, but we are seeing the light after it has passed through some kind of a stationary medium. In fact, even as late as the early 60s, we were left with no definite proof for the velocity, for the validity of Einstein's postulate on the constancy of the velocity of light. Does this imply that Moon and Spencer are correct? Is the universe so small that light from its most distant parts takes only 15.7 years to arrive to Earth? Well, let's discuss this. Let us look at the difficulties with Moon and Spencer's formulation. First, Moon and Spencer, in effect, want to place the material bodies of the universe at a different location than what is inferred from the radiation they emit. Pay careful attention to their statement, which you can see on the previous page, but which the relevant part I've quoted here. Quote, the usual distance employed by astronomers is unchanged as regards material bodies, but for light, it is replaced by the corresponding Riemannian distance. Now, we may have a point if astronomers measure distances by laying meter sticks end to end from the Earth to the objects whose distance they are measuring, and then compare this result to that obtained by viewing the radiation emitted by the object. Basically, what I'm saying is the following. The only way an astronomer can tell the distance to an object, other than the Moon or Mars or Saturn or Jupiter, because actually a piece of equipment or human beings have gone there, but once you get out of the solar system, once you're looking for the distance to other parts of the galaxy, or you're looking to the distance to other galaxies, the only way you can measure that distance is to look at the light emitted by these objects and analyze it in a way that will give you the distance, and there are various methods that are used. Now, what they want to do is keep the material objects far away, but let the light come through some kind of a path that will bring it here in 15 and a half light years. Now, basically, the way you would show that this is the situation would be as follows. You would have to take meter sticks from the Earth and lay them end to end all the way out to the object and then measure the distance to the object and then compare that distance to what you get astronomically. Otherwise, there's no way I can see how they can separate the so-called usual distance employed by astronomers, but then have another distance for light. The usual distance employed by astronomers, the only way in which a distance is measured, is by viewing the light that comes from this particular object. Astronomers do not use meter sticks to measure distances. They use the radiation emitted by objects. Hence, the distance inferred by astronomers is precisely the so-called Riemannian distance. Second, while the Moon and Spencer hypothesis explains the lack of multiple images in spectroscopic binaries and Cepheid variables, it introduces its own multiple images. A universe as small as they propose, that is one in which light only takes 15 years to get here, a universe as small as they propose would be full of images resulting from the bending of radiation emitted by nearby sources. In effect, their hypothesis implies that objects which we observe are composed of nothing more than the overlapping reflections of a few nearby sources. Now, let me show you what I mean by that. The only illustration I can have in showing curved space is to use a two-dimensional model. I'll be referring to this diagram in terms of something else as well. Suppose you wanted a curved space, a small curved space. Hard to do it in three dimensions, but suppose now you were limited to being on the surface of a balloon or the surface of some kind of a spherical object, a baseball or something like that. To you, you would be a two-dimensional person on the surface of a ball. Hence, you wouldn't really see what we would call up and down. You'd be limited to the surface. Now, in terms of the proposal by Moon and Spencer, basically what you have is a situation
in three-dimensional space that is similar to what you have on this diagram, where light would be confined to traveling along the surface of this balloon, like so. Now, I claim you would have multiple images for the following reason. Here's a galaxy at a certain distance. The light from this galaxy can come directly to us along this route, or since this is a closed surface, light emitted from the galaxy could travel in the opposite direction, go all the way around the reverse side of this ball, and hit us from the opposite direction as well. With this type of a situation, with a universe this small, you would look in one direction and see something, but the light coming to us from that object can also take the reverse direction all the way around and come to us from the reverse direction as well. You should be able to see a mirror image of the universe as you look out into space. If you look in one direction, you should see exactly what you see in the other direction. The only difference would be in the other direction would be a little fainter because, in effect, the light has to travel a greater distance as it goes around behind than what it does when it comes to us directly. It would be a little bit like sitting in a cubicle box with perfectly reflecting surfaces on the walls, on the ceiling, and on the floor with a candle, and you would be observing this candle reflected through all these mirrors. And in effect, this small of a universe makes everything that we see the composite image of a few nearby objects that have whose radiation is coming to us from different directions. And the point I make here is, are we really to believe that something like the Andromeda Galaxy is really just a few nearby stars whose light is going around in a peculiar type way in different directions to give rise to the spectacular galaxy that we see? This is a little hard to believe. A third problem, with a Riemannian curvature of only 5 light years, objects farther than about 7.8 light years, the circumference divided by 4, half the diameter, would exhibit an increase in apparent size with distance. Let me show you why that is the case. Here again you have a closed universe. Again, the ball analogy. One way that you can tell that one object is farther than another object, look at this first diagram up above. Suppose you have two galaxies that are the same size. The one that is farther away is going to look smaller. A human being that is far away from us looks smaller than somebody who's close to us. The angle subtended by the object that we are observing gets smaller and smaller as the object moves farther and farther away from us. In a closed universe like this, so-called Riemannian space, you would get the same effect as long as the galaxy is closer than, in this particular case, where the object is, where the observer is on the pole. This line here represents the equator. As the object moves away from us towards the equator, the angle that it subtends would appear to get smaller and smaller. But then once it crosses the equator and moves down towards the other pole, then something very peculiar happens, because the light that travels from this object is going to take the path of a great circle around. And in this particular case, where the galaxy is between the pole and the equator, the light going along the great circle subtends a small angle given by delta 1 in the diagram. The same object, same linear dimension, down near the other pole, however, look at the angle it's going to subtend. As the light curves around, as the light follows the great circle, it curves around. And as a result, as we observe this object, which is really farther away, the second object here is farther away than the first object, nevertheless it will appear larger. Fainter, but larger. What you will find is that objects that are farther and farther away will appear to get larger and larger as you get closer and closer to the antipole, to where the observer is located. So that is an effect that has not been seen. In fact, all galaxies that are observed, those which appear to be farther away, are smaller, they are fainter, and everything behaves very nicely. This is another reason why this particular proposal should be rejected, because this effect of the enlarging of an object as it gets farther away from us has not been seen. One analogy that I give here in the top of page 8
is sort of like looking at having a spherical mirror, like a shaving mirror, and moving back close to the focus of the mirror. Eventually, what you see in the mirror, as you're close, you see your face. As you get back, it gets more and more distorted and enlarged. And then as you move back, where your eye is right at the focal point of the spherical mirror, in effect, all you see is your eye filling up the whole mirror. This is the type of effect that you would see in such a closed universe as proposed by Moon and Spencer. None of these effects has been observed. Moon and Spencer's hypothesis, therefore, should be abandoned. But we're still left with Fox's criticism of De Sitter and Bergman. Could it be that Ritz's hypothesis is correct, but that Moon and Spencer have incorrectly used it? Definitely not. Decisive evidence for the validity of Einstein's postulate on the velocity of light has been proved by a number of experimenters, which I have mentioned. And the method that is used to prove that the validity of Einstein's second postulate, that the speed of light is constant regardless of how fast the emitting source is moving, is done by so-called time-of-flight experiments with unstable objects that decay. The example I've shown here is a so-called pi meson or pion that is moving with roughly the speed of light. These can be produced in accelerators. These are unstable particles. They're short-lived. They travel a short distance, anywhere between about 5 to 8 meters after they are produced. Even at the velocity of light, they are so short-lived. They travel about 5 to 8 meters and then decay into gamma rays. Gamma rays being very, very high-energy X-rays. Now, if the pion is moving at a velocity near the velocity of light and decays into gamma rays, one way to show that the Ritz hypothesis would be correct would be to measure the velocity of the gamma rays, and if the velocity of the gamma rays turns out to be twice the velocity of light, represented by C, then Ritz would be correct. On the other hand, if the velocity of the gamma rays is only the velocity of the normal speed of light, C, then Einstein is correct. A number of experiments have been done like this, using pions, using positrons, and in every case, the velocity of the gamma rays that are emitted is always the same as the velocity of light, where the velocity of the emitting particle can vary anywhere between 75% to 99.9% of the velocity of light. And in every case, the gamma rays that are emitted are always moving at the velocity of light. A number of experiments like this on Earth, which showed once and for all, these were done in the middle to late 60s, showed once and for all that the Ritz hypothesis was incorrect. And even if you don't believe everything else I said concerning the funny-looking universe that Moon and Spencer proposed, their proposal is based on the Ritz hypothesis. And the Ritz hypothesis now has been shown to be incorrect. The speed of light is independent of the speed of the source. It is not at all dependent on the speed of the source as Ritz had proposed. In no case of all the experiments given in the middle of the page was the velocity of the gamma rays increased or decreased as proposed by Ritz. Now, in addition to the above Earth-based experiments, Brecker has used radiation from pulsars to show that the speed of light is independent of the motion of the source as well. Basically, what he did is to use X-rays emitted by pulsars, and he pretty much did the same experiment that De Sitter tried to do visually. The advantage of using X-rays is that X-rays are not subject to Fox's criticism, to Fox's criterion. X-rays pass through the atmospheres of the pulsars without being slowed down at all. And he basically showed that the speed of light was constant as well. Neither Brecker's experiment nor the ones mentioned in the preceding paragraph were subject to Fox's criticism. Hence, both terrestrial and extraterrestrial observations have shown once and for all that Ritz's hypothesis is invalid. Similarly, since Moon and Spencer based their hypothesis on Ritz, their proposal should also be abandoned and not used in further discussions on the age of the universe. Let me just add a postscript here. Lately, there have been some proposals made that the speed of light has actually changed through the history of the universe, and that in the past, the speed of light was much, much greater than what it is now. And hence, what that would in effect do is make the universe appear younger than what it is. Because the measurement of an object, let's say being a few billion light years away, is based on the current speed of light.
If light were traveling much, much faster in the early history of the universe, let's say back 6, 10, 15,000 years ago, the speed of light was enormously faster than what it is now, then over a short period of time, you cover that great distance. And now it has slowed down. But using the present speed of light, which is slow compared to what it would have been back then, the object appears to be much farther away than what it actually is. In fact, this is mentioned by the newsletter that Paul gave me. A fellow who has done quite a bit of this work is a fellow called Barry Setterfield from Australia. Let me just mention in postscript that two very crucial experiments were done back in the late 70s that showed that the speed of light has been constant over the course of many millions of years. In fact, the experimental result is that the speed of light has not changed any more than one part in a trillion per year over the course of 1 year. And making a fast calculation, this shows that the relative change in the speed of light over the course of the history of the universe, which if we assume is 20 billion years old, amounts to about 2%. And hence that would give rise to about 2% air in the distance. So something instead of being 1 billion light years away is really 0.98 billion light years away. In other words, it really would not be that much of an effect. So I have the references to the experiments if you want them. Show you where they can be found. And basically, these experiments should end any talk about the speed of light changing over the course of the history of the universe. It appears that the speed of light has been constant. That coupled with the experiments that show that the speed of light is independent of the motion of the source, I would hope would lay to rest this present theory that tries to explain the size of the universe, trying to take the size of the universe and bring it down to something smaller. Again, this is based on the Ritz hypothesis, which has been shown to be incorrect. You cannot use a variation in the speed of light over the course of the history of the universe. Maybe it's about time for that particular theory to try to explain the age of the universe should be abandoned at this point. And with that, I will end. I'll be more than happy to answer any questions that you might have on what was given. If you all want to race home to see the election results. Yes, sir.
Do you believe that the universe is several billion years old?
I personally do. I personally do not find that a problem. Yes, Ken.
Two, I guess, simplified questions. One is, it's difficult for me to understand why someone would say light travels more rapidly in a curved path than in a straight line.
It's difficult for me to understand that fully as well, because you would see, but that is predicated on thinking in the Euclidean sense, where the shortest distance between two points is in effect a straight line. But it's hard to get an analogy like that. Basically, a better analogy would be in the diagram that I had to try to illustrate what they did. Although that's not the terms in which they speak. Would be to have the distance that astronomers measure along the surface, but somehow have the light sort of travel through the sphere in order to shorten up the distance. But they even give an equation that presumably does this, that will take very large distances and compress them into something no more than 15.7 light years. But basically what they say is, one way of saying that, suppose you really have an observer here and an object here, and they would claim the astronomer thinks he's measuring this distance, but in effect the light only travels this far. That type of thing. You curve things in such a way to try to speed up the time that the light would take to reach us.
15 billion.
Did I say 15?
I'm just saying that 15 versus 15.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. But see, they say, okay, the object, we observe the object is far away, but the light really sort of snuck here in a way that didn't take more than 15.7 years.
My other question was, when you were talking about eccentricity of a binary star, and you were saying that they actually observed circular paths, and yet that is also by the light that the star emits. How can they really determine that it is a circular path and not elliptical if you're actually measuring?
Right. What you do is look at the orbit of the motion of the binaries that appears, and then say, what should be the masses of the stars?
you try to find, using Newton's laws, what would be the masses of the stars, and with those kind of masses, then what kind of speed would you expect, what kind of orbit would you expect given the distances between the stars. And you would see if that really fits in with what you actually observe. In other words, you try to correlate what you observe with Newton's laws and see if there's a correlation there. And there was. It was. Newton's laws would tell you, see, if you have what appears to be a circular orbit, but for some reason this star is moving much faster in this part of the circular orbit than in this part of the circular orbit, then you know something's funny. Now, you take, now it may be that you have an elliptical orbit, but that it is skewed somewhat. You factor that out. But the idea would be, let's say, for purposes of analogy, you see a circular orbit where you expect, according to Newton's laws, for the object to be rotating around the central object at a constant velocity, but you see it speeds up here and slows down here, as it should if you indeed had an elliptical orbit. The things would not correlate. The appearance of the binary would not correlate with what you would expect by analyzing the binary mechanically through Newton's laws. Oh, there are elliptical orbits. Right. And the thing is, you can have an elliptical orbit. Let's say you have an orbit that is elliptical like so, but skewed in such a way that it looks circular, but you understand that even though it looks circular, if the object is speeding up in one part of the orbit, then in another part of the orbit, or if it looks circular, as it's projected against the sky, but the central object is really here, then you don't have a problem. But again, all that can be factored out. That can be analyzed. And what the sitter was trying to do is, after all these effects of inclined orbits were factored out, you would still have a spurious component left over, if indeed the light speeded up while the star was moving towards us and slowed up as it was moving away from us, and he did not find this. Of course, he didn't know Fox's criterion at that time either.
There's another factor that if you come in there, you wouldn't have to know the shape of the orbit. In Ritz's hypothesis, since the light comes to us faster when it's moving towards us, slower when it's moving away, it's going to look like that all binary stars, when they're moving towards us, are moving faster, and when they're moving away, are moving slower. Which means that if you're actually looking at the dynamics of orbit, no matter what shape it is, the two stars are closer together when the one star is approaching us, and they're further apart when the one star is moving away. And the question after looking at several hundred binaries is, why is that?
Yeah.
What's special about
order? Right. Right.
Go faster, come towards us, rather than come faster, going away from
us. Right.
Naturally. And there you don't need any shape in the orbit, are you?
Yes.
Yeah,
you right. You see, right. You do see a random, you have enough stars, you see a random population with various orientations, and as Bob said, you know, you would expect half the stars to be moving faster when they're coming towards us, and half to be moving faster going away from us as a result of an ellipticity of the orbit. But if for some reason all of them are moving faster while they're coming towards us, you would think something is funny. Yes, sir.
I was just curious. In your first script, you mentioned the other theory where at one time the light was traveling faster than now. You mentioned some experiments at this group that, could you just elaborate on what they were?
Yeah, basically what the people did, there is a relationship between the energy of light that comes to us and two concepts. One is the velocity of light, and the other one is so-called Planck's constant. And what you have is, this is equal to the energy of the radiation times the wavelength of the radiation. By working with apparatus that measured energy and wavelength, they were able to get a handle on whether these two constants had changed. One experiment showed that the quantity HC was a constant throughout the course of a long period of time. And then the other experiment was able to check out, by another method, whether Planck's constant had changed. And they found that this was also constant through time. Hence, if the product of the two was a constant, then the speed of light was also constant. It was kind of an indirect type of measurement, but the conclusions would still be valid. They weren't measuring the speed of light per se, but they were able to measure the product of H times C and then measure what H had been doing. Both by looking at the... Well, some experiments that looked primarily at the wavelength of light as it came from what presumably were different parts of the universe, and others that stuck primarily with the frequency and then making a comparison of the two. A rather elaborate kind of experiment, but the two of them together have to be taken together to show that the speed of light has been constant. Okay.
I think it's very simple in my mind. You said 1 light year is 6 trillion miles. So, 4 by 15, 7 times 6. That's, you mean at the furthest point in the universe, say 100 trillion miles away? Or 96, or...
In the scheme where you have 15.7, it takes 15.7 years. Right, so the... So here again, that's just the travel time for the light at maximum. Again, the object may be, as far as they see it, the object may be farther away. In other words, what they say is, look, let's say the universe is 6,000 years old, and something was created billions of light years away. So what? It's not going to take billions of light years for the light to get here. It's only going to take 15 and a half years for the light to get here. And this is the thing that's troublesome in my mind, how they separate the space in which the light travels from the space in which the material objects are found. That's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, but then you can't say that the object that it's coming from is 100 trillion miles away. Or can you? No, you're saying the outside space of the light?
I wouldn't say it. I don't know what was going through their minds, though.
Wait, can I say that the furthest point of our universe is 100 trillion miles away from here? Can I use that?
100 trillion miles.
15.7 times 6.
I would say the farthest point of the universe is much farther than that. What you'd have to take is roughly 8 billion and multiply by 6 trillion. I mean, if you accept the distance, if you accept the distance scales that astronomers have, then the farthest out that we've been able to see to some quasars would be 8 billion light years times 6 trillion miles. 8 billion times 6 trillion in terms of miles. If the universe has a radius, as they say, where the farthest point is 15.7 light years away, then it's 15.7 times 6 trillion, or roughly 100 trillion.
That would make it a young universe.
That would make it a young universe.
Would they be saying that to travel? To
actually travel between a couple objects in that space,
you would not try to travel in line of sight, that the actual
root
spaceship would take you through some different route.
Yeah, if such a thing exists.
But how fast would you get there?
Yeah.
You couldn't know where you're looking.
No, see, those are other problems that you have when you try to separate the space in which the light travels from the space in which the material objects are found. But as they say, In the quote, on page 5, he says, in essence, therefore, the method of this paper leaves astronomical space unchanged but reduces the time required for light to travel from a star to the Earth. It seems like what they're saying is, we'll leave the objects out there as far as you want them, but it's not going to take more than 15.7 years for the light to get here.
I don't know why they didn't just...
Maybe in one way they were recognizing some of the difficulty that they would have, but the difficulties aren't removed by having a different way for the light to get here. See, part of the problem is when you're looking at an object, are you looking at its ghost image because the light has gone around several loops and finally come in from that direction, or is the object really there? You know, the whole structure of the universe, aside from the experiments that have been done to show that the speed of light is constant, the whole structure of the universe really turns out to be very, very peculiar under those circumstances. You know, let alone this other effect of objects getting larger as they move farther away past a certain distance. You know, very, very weird effects that take place. Yes, sir.
Earlier you mentioned about the speed of light has been very definitely demonstrated not to have changed. And I think you said something about over a period of time. How was that demonstrated in a short period of time, not that it happened in a long period of time?
You take a look at light coming from objects that are various distances. And what you do is you look at objects that the light coming from objects that are billions of light years away, or what you think are billions of light years away. Yes.
It's really not an observable phenomenon because we're starting out with an assumption that these two objects are in two different positions to us based on our knowledge of how fast light travels.
The distance scale is accepted. The distance scale to the objects is accepted. then you make that assumption, you say, is it self-consistent?
So we haven't been a circular reason, really, in saying that we know that these two objects are different distances from us because the speed of light is thus and so, and so we're saying, therefore, the speed of light is constant.
Well, what we're saying is that let's test our assumption that the objects are... We assume that the two objects are at different distances, but then what we're not trying to check that. We're trying to check to see whether the objects are, whether the light emitted by these objects are, has been constant, whether the speed of light has been constant emitted by these objects. Now, whether the distance, the cosmic distance scale is accurate or not, that's a whole other discussion. But astronomers accept it quite firmly. At the very most, the farthest parts of the universe that are observable may have the distance that is measured plus or minus 50% at the very most. That's still a long ways away from what is necessary to shrink, let's say, a universe that's 20,000, 20 billion years old down to, you know, maybe you can shrink it down to 10 billion years.
Another problem I don't quite understand is why we equate distance and speed of light with age. There are two, I think there are two separate theories. One thing we can say is if we know that the star was out there so many billions of years and the Earth was created at the same time and that light, that star was turned on at that time and then we did not see it for this many billions of years, then we could equate distance and speed of light with age. However, we do not know that the star was not created at the same time of the Earth and there was no light being created at the same time. We do not know that. That's assumed not to have taken place.
I understand. Are you saying that the light then would be created on the way? In other words, when I look at a star... Right. But in effect, then, what you have is again, this is a sub-corollary of apparent age. Because, in effect, if I see an object that is, according to my calculations, a billion light years away, in effect, it has told me that the light has taken a billion years to get here. Now, if you say the light was really created on the way, or when the object was created, the light was already created on its way here, and already having arrived to Earth, to me, that's just a subset of the whole apparent age argument that is used not only in astronomy, but also in geology and what have you. Well... My supposition is that if I'm looking at an object at a certain distance and the light is being emitted from that object, that the light started out from that object when it was created. And unless the speed of light is instantaneous, I would not see it until a number of years went by equal to the distance in light years. But the problem I have with having the light on the way is, again, the problem I have with all apparent age type of arguments, which is...
Well, it seems to me the apparent age type argument really is kind of... we are assuming that something is old. It has not been created with that.
No, we're not assuming it. It's a logical assumption that if something is far away, you know, the assumption I use is that the light is not going to begin traveling from that object before the object is created. After it's created, the light begins to travel to me. And if the light speed has been constant, then all I have to do is measure the number of years that it would take the light to get here, and I know how far it is. Or, conversely, if I know how far it is by some other method, then I know how long it's taken the light to reach. And then the age is at least that large.
Suppose someone had not known about the Nazca Helms eruption, and they knew they found records somewhere the mountain was so high, and now they measure the mountain, and it's only about 2,000 feet, plus, I guess, the sun. And they estimate it took so many millions of years for that to wear down, as they say about the Appalachians. Isn't this the same type of reasoning that you're using with the stars?
No. No, the reason I wouldn't accept the analogy that you're giving is because geologists know processes that are cataclysmic and that can wipe out a mountain, in effect, as happens in volcanoes. you would have to find an analogy where a similar type of cataclysmic event would occur in astronomy that would speed up the light that would get here. There's even uniformitarians recognize that certain cataclysms occur that speed up processes tremendously. I'd have to see an analogy that is similar in astronomy, that something would occur that would speed up the light that would come to me. Do you have a question?
That was suggesting changes in the speed of light. I don't understand where that idea proposed that. What mechanism would it be to suggest that that's an idea that should be entertained?
Basically, a number of physicists from the early part of this century were wondering whether the constants of nature, that we call constants, like the speed of light, Planck's constant, the charge in an electron, all these things, were really constant or not, or whether there was a slow variation over a long period of time. Such a long period of time that even in the number of years that we've been measuring these constants, you really wouldn't see much of a change. Well, astronomy provides a laboratory whereby you can do this, because again, if you accept that the objects are far away, then in effect, the light that you receive from an object that has a certain frequency, a certain wavelength, all these things are dependent upon these basic physical constants. And if we can analyze the light properly from a distant object and see that it behaves like light that we generate here in the laboratory, then we have a measure of comparison as to whether the light, these constants have changed or not.
So no mechanism is suggesting.
No mechanism, no, yeah. No.
If they found the change, then they go for a mechanism.
No, yeah. Right, now, as far as I know, you know, the proposal, Dirac, by the way, who just died about a week or so ago, a great British physicist, was one of the first people that started thinking along those lines, and a number of others have as well. I'm not aware of a mechanism. They're just wondering whether this is the case or not. Yes, sir?
Not being an astronomer, and I wouldn't want you to go into any long explanation, but the astronomers look into the heavens and they see all the stars and they come up with distances that the light is far from, and some are billions and billions of years and some aren't. And they see pinpoints of light and they say, so how do they know these distances? Are they really distances, or have they assumed certain things?
Basically, the way it is measured, once you get beyond the solar system, is the method of parallax, where you see an apparent shift in a nearby object with respect to a distant object. For example, if you hold up your finger and wink one eye, then the other, you'll see the position of your finger jump with respect to the distant object. Well, the same thing happens
to stars that are close with respect to stars that are far away. Let's say this is the sun, this is the orbit of the Earth, here's a nearby star, and here are some distant stars. And at one time of the year, you'll see this nearby star apparently projected over in this part of the sky, and then another part of the year, you see the star projected in this part of the sky. Going this distance to the sun, which can be measured very accurately, you can then, knowing this angle, this triangle, by the way, is very, very small, you can calculate the distance to that star. Once that distance to a number of these stars, several thousand of these stars are measured, we find something very interesting, and that is that there is a very direct correlation between the spectrum of a star, if you analyze the various wavelengths of light given off by the star, and the absolute brilliance of the star. That becomes like a standard candle, is the astronomer's terminology. If you know how bright a candle is, and you also know that if you take it farther and farther away from yourself, the candle gets dimmer and dimmer. So the basic method then results in measuring distances beyond the parallax is as follows. You look at a star that is far away that you cannot measure by parallax. However, you measure the spectrum. The spectrum of that star looks exactly like the star whose distance you can measure. You know the absolute brightness of the star that whose distance you can measure. You know the brightness of the star whose distance you can't measure, but you know how much farther away your known star must be in order to look that faint. Now, if you know how bright a street lamp is, it's far enough away, it looks a lot dimmer, but if you know what the absolute brightness of a street lamp is, you can calculate the distances between the street lamp. And that's the method that is used. That's the basic method that is used. So you use distances that you know, that you calculate geometrically, for several thousand stars whose absolute brightness and whose spectrum are well known. Then you measure the spectrum of other stars and you use the comparison between what they appear to, how bright they appear to be, with what their absolute brightness is, that gives you the distance to them. That can enable you then, to find distances to various galaxies. Then you begin to use galaxies as a whole and use the same method. So you really build one on top of the other. And maybe in this particular method, the parallax method, you have 10% error. Then you go to the method I mentioned using stars, the error increases to about 20%. Then you go to galaxies, maybe add about another 10% of curvature. Then you build out. So finally you measure the velocity at which objects are moving away from you, and there's a correlation between how fast they're moving away from you and how far away they are, so-called Hubble's law. By the time you get out that far, at the very most, you maybe plus or minus 50%. That means the size of the universe is anywhere between 10 billion and 20 billion, years, the age, 10 billion, 20 billion years. Again, assuming that the object that is far away is, took the light at least that long after it was emitted from the object to reach us here on Earth. That's basically how you find distances. So it's not an inaccurate, in other words, there is a certain amount of error, probable error with the distance measurements. But to get something from a few billion years down to a few thousand years, you have to have almost a million-fold increase in the error of the measurements and what at the time was actually measured. Which people in astronomy just say, boy, they couldn't have boxed it that much.
If you accept that these distances are correct and that you have a lower limit on the age of the universe is maybe 10, 20 billion years, do you think that from a Christian point of view, does that really say anything about the age of the Earth? Not necessarily. No.
Not necessarily, no. The age of the Earth would be different methods that are used. The only thing I can say from an astronomical standpoint is that planets are seen to be an outcome of the formation of stars, and there are ways of measuring the ages of stars. And hence, any planets associated with the star would be about that old. Now, if you look at the sun and various theories concerning the operation of the sun, the formation of the sun, it comes out, it appears to be about 5 billion years old. Radiometric measurements of the Earth make it about 4.6 billion years. So again, there's a consistency there. Basically, the way you can measure these things, with the sun it's a little more difficult, but with other stars, is that in a star's lifetime, in the core, because of the nuclear reactions, you transmute some elements into other elements. And if you have a star that has convection, these elements then are brought to the surface and can be measured spectroscopically. Now, we know roughly what the composition of these elements were when the star would have begun forming. And then we can see the change in the abundances of these elements, especially various isotopes of these elements, and using present theories, you can calculate how old the star is.
So then you would put the date of creation somewhere around 5.5 billion years ago?
No, even beyond that. So the creation of the universe is about 20 billion.
The creation of the Earth, since the sun is about 5.5 billion years old.
Right.
Created at the same time.
Right. Creation of the Earth, I would put back that far, but other things had happened before the sun actually formed. So from the creation of the universe to the creation of the sun, formation of the sun, you could have anywhere between about roughly 15 billion years worth of time going by. Thank you very much.